Vikander Need, Technical Media. Cursed media is a pretty old concept in horror, reaching back plenty of decades to things like The Picture of Dorian Gray and the music of Eric Zan, and entering into the more modern age with films like The Ring or Incantation. The SCP universe has hundreds of articles with the media tag, so there's no shortage of SCPs that fit the bill, but today we're going to be looking at a relatively new group of interest devoted to making anomalous pieces of media. While their anomalies are not generally malicious in nature, they're not the sort of things that the Foundation wants in the hands of the average citizen, and unfortunately, they keep ending up there. Let's take a look. To begin with, unlike many of the groups of interest, VKTM is specifically intended to be mysterious, with no knowledge of their organizational structure, how they started, or how they manufacture anomalies. While it can often be pretty interesting to delve deeper and deeper into the lore of an anomalous group, this fact certainly makes my job a bit easier. All we really know about them is that they are entirely focused on all aspects of media production and distribution, and have produced anomalous radio shows, instructional VHS tapes, exercise DVDs, bonus features on entertainment DVDs, documentaries, music, and streaming services. They've been around since the 1950s and show no sign of slowing down, continuing to produce media that is largely either unsettling or sickly humorous. And with the Foundation still mostly in the dark about how they operate, they represent a pretty big threat to the Veil. Really then, the best thing to do is just to get into some of the articles about VKTM, to better understand what exactly they're producing. Let's start with the first VKTM article, SCP-5889. Which is a mimetic cognitohazard that takes the form of broadcasts, originating from a radio station self-designated as VKTM-66.3. Individuals who hear the broadcast are immediately affected in two ways, reporting irrational terror and distress during the broadcast, and afterwards being unable to remember the content of the broadcast. They do, however, retain memories of the emotional duress suffered, even after multiple courses of amnestic treatment. The broadcasts have so far only occurred within the continental US, although they are unpredictable and lack any observable patterns. Frequently, they only occur in the presence of solitary individuals, and in fact, there hasn't been any recorded instance affecting more than two individuals. It's currently theorized that the instances are targeted, but the method by which individual victims are chosen is unclear. After being exposed, an individual will often respond with a fight-or-flight response, and given the amnestic properties of the broadcast, affected individuals are unable to locate the offending stimulus, increasing their panic and the irrationality of their actions. This can be particularly dangerous and disruptive if the affected individual is driving when exposure to the instance occurs. Incidents of violence are relatively rare, but individuals affected are often found to take hazardous actions in an attempt to escape the cause of their terror. So far, the source of these broadcasts has not been discovered, no origin of radio waves has been identified, and the method by which the signal is being transmitted is unknown. The first recorded instance occurred in the Colorado town of Crested Butte on November 14, 1959. A radio personality calling himself Kilimanjaro, and joined by someone named Duke, introduces the show as the Saturday Evening Dementia Radio Hour. When prompting Duke to add to that, the sound of metal scraping and squealing as it tears is heard for the next 30 seconds. The frequency and pitch were such that glass reportedly cracked within 5 miles of the downtown Crested Butte area. Kilimanjaro states that he never feels more alive than when Duke is pontificating, and then an air horn sound effect is heard, and he announces that they have a request for a shout-out to one of their listeners, Amy Kling. Her mother wants her to know that she's fine, she's doing well, and she doesn't have to worry. She wanted to keep her updated about the rat that broke in and has been giving her trouble. He started nibbling down by her toes, and she thinks he likes her, because he's been going hog wild down there for the last hour. The maggots crawled through her left eye yesterday, but she's still got the right eye, and there's not much to see down there. Her mama just wanted her to know that she's liquefying right according to schedule, and she can't wait to see her next week. More metal shrieking noises are heard before Kilimanjaro moves on to the weather. On January 26, 1961, another broadcast was recorded in Macon, Georgia, featuring a debate between two academics, Professor Keller and Dr. Irving Waits. Keller speaks about control and how we walk around with this obsessive need to keep a vice grip on every aspect of our lives. He suggests that we should let some things go, although Irving Waits is against sacrificing his independence, as free will is pretty important to him. Keller replies that you don't need to decide every single aspect of your life to be happy. He says to take three things out of your daily activities and let them decide for you, and he guarantees that you'll be happier. Things like your finances, your voting, and whether or not you go to church that week. Small things like that. Irving Waits retorts that that doesn't sound great to him, as they're lizards, not people, after all. Keller says that that's nonsense, as reptiles have been evolving and surviving longer than humanity has been breaking rocks. The wisdom of the reptilian elite, of which he is blessed to claim a part of, is something ancient and mystical. You can literally learn more listening to a lizard in an hour than you would in a full day at a university. It's hard to walk around with a gecko balanced on your shoulders, but you get used to the stares. On April 18, 1972, another broadcast was recorded in the Rogue River Valley area in Oregon, featuring a news anchor reporting on some breaking news. Reporters at the station have uncovered the real reason for President JFK's assassination, being that he was a stupid capitalist who was friends with mobsters and illustrated everything most corrupt with this country. They shot him in the head, twice, and his wife picked up part of his brains because she was the embodiment of women's subservience to the patriarchy in this nation. His assassination served as a warning, and panicked murmuring can be heard for roughly 8 seconds. The news anchor comments that that's the sound of your pathetic misconceptions about homosexuality, about race, about gender, about socialism, about education. He then says that someone should kick Mike in the brain, specifically calling out Michael Sinclair, 4543 Rosewater Drive, Grants Pass, Oregon, zip code 97526. Someone should kick him in the brain, and maybe his wife would pick up the little pieces, but he doubts it, with the way Mike speaks to her like she's property. Despite not being able to remember the contents of the broadcast, Mike sold his house and moved within 2 months of the event. More panicked murmuring can be heard for roughly 12 seconds, and the news anchor continues, telling Mike that he doesn't matter at all to America. This country is going to kill him, and it's going to refuse to offer treatment along the way. And when his brain is kicked in, he bets that he'll be wishing the socialist agenda would stick its nose into his business and pay for all the surgeries, so he doesn't end up a vegetable. The news anchor finishes by returning listeners to the regularly scheduled programming of Dolly's Dixie Corner. But from everyone at VKTM 66.3, he wishes the corpse of JFK a merry F.U. and an F.U. to Mike as well. Another instance occurred on July 3rd, 1987 in San Diego at exactly midnight. The announcer states that usually at VKTM 66.3 they like to sign off on a message of positivity, but they just can't do that today. Today is the day they won. Today is the day they finally broke down the doors of the gubernatorial mansion in Sacramento and dragged out their beloved Governor Duke Majan. Indecipherable chanting begins in the background as the announcer continues, stating that those dirty Satanist pigs pulled the governor out into the street and they forced him to drink goat's blood and take the Dark Lord's sacrament. That means that Christianity is now forbidden by law, The chanting gets louder, but it's not in any recognizable language. The announcer tells the listeners to throw away your Bibles and gather up the pastors and nuns and priests and imams and rabbis, because they only get two choices, convert or die. Those conservative Christian types warned us about ungodliness, and we just didn't listen. The chanting grows quieter and then fades out entirely, as the announcer declares that this concludes their scheduled programming, and they'll see us tomorrow for Kilimanjaro and the Duke. After 30 seconds of silence, the announcer finishes by praising the Dark Lord. An instance occurred on May 27th, 2002, in Beaumont, Indiana, with it being an excerpt of the morning show previously recorded by Kilimanjaro and the Duke. Kilimanjaro returns from a commercial break and announces that they have one hell of a scoop for their favorite listeners. The itch that Marjorie Shule feels on her backside are actually spiders, and they just entered her cavities. He doesn't want to say which ones, because this is a family show, but he assumes that it's going to itch something fierce. He tells her not to worry, though, as they're only inside her to lay some 3,000 to 4,000 eggs, and when they hatch, he's sure they'll burrow right through her intestines, lickety-split. 16 separate air horns are fired into the microphone for 12 seconds, and Kilimanjaro finishes by saying that Marjorie liked Charlotte's Web just a little too much, and she should read more interesting books next time. On August 9th, 1997, in Miami, a broadcast took the form of an adult-themed late-night radio show. A host named Mistress Madeline welcomes listeners to Late Night VKTM and says that if they want to get to know her, they should pick up the phones and pound in that number. A moaning sound is then heard, which means that they have someone on the line. The caller greets her, stating that his name is Dinesh, and he's been a big fan for a long time. He's in the car with the radio on, and his wife's in the house, asleep in bed. She doesn't know that he listens to her, but he does this every night. Madeline tells him that she loves it when people tell her that they sneak listen to her, and she asks what he does for a living, and if he's going to treat her right. Dinesh replies that he just works in an office, but Madeline tells him that that doesn't rule him out, and asks when his last promotion was. He admits that it was some time ago, and he tells his wife he's doing well, but he doesn't want to lie to Madeline. She tells him that she's got a task for him to do, and he says that he'll do anything, as panting sounds can be heard. She tells him to walk into his boss's office, get down on his knees, and beg him for some sort of validation. It's going to hurt his pride, but she's worth it, and he should throw in some tears. Then he should stay on his knees and wait there until his boss gives him something, even if it's just a pat on the head. Then he should say, "Thank you for effing me," because that's what's happening every day that he's in that dead-end job. He should then stay on his knees and crawl out of the office. She calls him pathetic and tells him to go back to his wife before hanging up on him. She finishes by saying that it was good for her and moves on to the next caller. We then have an instance that occurred on October 14th, 2004, in Billings, Montana. An excerpt of a call-in talk radio show. The host, Veronica Hartwell, says that they're going to be together for the next 2 hours, and she wants to hear from the listeners. If they're having relationship problems, or struggling with their life goals, or just struggling to get by, they should call her up for a chat, and she'll pretend to listen like they matter. She then laughs and says that she's just kidding, as a man can be heard wailing on the recording. She takes her first caller, with 10 seconds passing without anyone speaking, and the wailing increases in volume. Hartwell just says that it sounds like the line went dead, and the caller should give her another ring. She moves on to the next caller, and there's 20 seconds with no one speaking. The wailing is now so loud that when the host begins speaking, she has to raise her voice to be heard, although she doesn't acknowledge it. She moves on to another caller, with 35 seconds of moaning being heard before ceasing. Hartwell asks if anyone is out there, and if anyone can hear her. Finally, we have the most recent noteworthy recording of a broadcast, which occurred on February 12th, 2013, in Huntington, West Virginia. The instance was a 30-minute episode of a talk show about mental health, hosted by Dr. Emily Goddard, PhD. Goddard greets her guest, Glenn, and says that they should get down to the core of the issue here. His girlfriend is angry because he's invested so much of his identity in the myth of masculinity, with Glenn asking if she thinks that men are a myth. She says that yes, absolutely, as humanity is a myth. He's not a living, feeling being with emotions and history. He's a corpse waiting to happen, and everyone around him is already dead. She's not being figurative here. They're literally dead bodies. His girlfriend is dead, his parents are dead, his fifth grade sweetheart, his math tutor in high school, his boss, all dead. She asks if he's ever heard of Cotard's delusion, a rare mental delusion in which the person believes that they are dead or otherwise don't exist. She says that it's not a delusion. He's dead, they're dead, and nothing he does even matters. He has as much tangible impact on the world around him as a pile of dirt. So the next time he's worried about saying the wrong thing or not quite understanding someone's reaction, just remember that he's a walking bundle of decomposing matter, and the soul, if it ever was real, left his body a long time ago. Glenn thanks her for really putting things into perspective, and she says that it's no problem, as it's what she does. With that, I think we get the basic framework of a VKTM SCP, which is weird, inexplicable, and without any attempt at explanation. Moving on, we have SCP-5904, the collective designation for a series of instructional VHS tapes entitled Human Resources Orientation, produced and distributed by VKTM. Currently, three instances are known to the Foundation, with their anomalous effects only being triggered when an instance is played for at least one individual. Subjects who watch one of the tapes develop increased suggestibility and are amenable to following any instruction that would not endanger their lives. The effect is cumulative, so the more content an individual watches, the more open to suggestion they will become. Additionally, subjects who watch the entire series report insomnia, apathy, lack of appetite, and an increase in anxiety regardless of their mental health history. So, a similar effect to watching the Hobbit movies. The suggestibility and other psychological effects fade with time, but recollections of the content of the tapes are highly resistant to amnestization. The content also cannot be copied through any known technology, whether digital or analog, and any attempts to duplicate an instance will produce only static. Various items of information concerning the viewing subject will be incorporated into the content contained within an instance, and the host of the series is never completely shown on camera. At most, the bottom 50% of his face will be visible, with his eyes never shown. He self-identifies as Charlie Fierro, Senior Vice President of VKTM's Human Resources Division. The tapes were discovered after an individual in Everett, Washington purchased them at a rummage sale. Martha Gutierrez, a 20-year-old student at the University of Washington, claims to have no memory of the location or event of the purchase, and the Foundation became aware of it after posts on Parawatch.net were discovered by dedicated AICs. Martha, posting as MG Paranoid, posted that she bought these videotapes at a rummage sale in her parents' neighborhood so that she could show them to her AV class as a joke. There was some personal drama right after she started the tape, however, so she left for a few minutes. When she came back, her classmates were all staring at the screen, with the VHS having stopped and the TV just displaying static. She says that they were a group of six people, totally independent college students with various issues and intellectual abilities, but they all just started following orders. She told them all to F off because they didn't pause the tape for her, and they all got up and started leaving. She then told them to wait a minute, and they all turned around and looked at her. She figured they were pulling a joke on her, but the next day she found one of them watching another one of the tapes in the AV lab, and she was freaking out. It turns out that the video was addressed to someone with her name, even though Emily isn't that strange of a name, so she started having a full-on panic attack. She told her that she needs to calm down, and she sort of did. She could still see in her eyes that she was somewhat freaked out, but she stopped pacing and stopped cursing. She just listened immediately. Martha was interviewed, but she failed to provide any information concerning the origins of the tapes, so she was amnesticized along with her classmates. We're given a notice from the Foundation Records and Information Security Administration informing us that reading transcripts of the video files has the same effect as viewing the videos themselves, so instead we're given excerpts from the transcripts. The initial transcripts were written up by researcher William Weddle, who is still recovering from doing so. In the first excerpt, the host takes off a suit coat and starts rolling up his sleeves. The setting is a classroom with a large blackboard, with the words, "Interviews, Framing the Narrative," written on it. The host says that you don't really ever want them to be too comfortable, so you should make it a little too hot or a little too cold to get them antsy. You should establish who's in charge early on, so if they want those health benefits, they're going to have to impress you. William impressed his interviewer when he came to work there, so that's how he got this important job. He then asks Weddle if that's right, before pausing for 30 seconds. He then says that he wasn't really listening, and that's the other thing. You should only half listen to the interviewee. You don't get to make the call if they're hired or not, so what does it matter what they say? Besides, you don't want to set a precedent. If you start listening to people when they come into your office, they'd probably start coming a lot more, and who wants that? Another excerpt shows the host sweeping a pile of bloody rags and human organs off the table in front of him and into a trash can. The trash can is overflowing with bones, viscera, and other biological material. He states that that's the end of the conflict resolution chapter, and asks who's ready for a break. In the last excerpt, the host opens a bedroom door, with the camera following closely behind him. He turns and gestures towards a bed containing Weddle, and he proceeds to adjust the blanket on top of him so that it covers Weddle's shoulders. He then turns to the camera and brings a finger to his lips, gesturing the camera away and walking over to Weddle's open closet. He then says that they should talk about hostile work environments, how to make them, and how to escalate. After 10 minutes, he's then standing in front of Weddle's open refrigerator, bending over and looking inside. His upper body is entirely hidden behind the open appliance door, and he noisily rummages while continuing to speak. He says that what we need to do is make sure that when someone complains of a hostile working environment, we don't solve the problem. If HR solved hostile work environments, what would the labor attorneys do for money? No, HR's job is different and has three parts: minimize the complaint, alienate the worker complaining, and make sure the one guilty of creating the hostile environment benefits in some noticeable way. He then throws a jar of pickles out of the fridge as he chews on something, and says that HR are not conflict resolution managers. They're human resources, so they manage the humans. He always says to keep your goal reasonable and keep your role in the company firmly entrenched in your mind. Otherwise, you're just filling out forms and solving problems for employees every waking hour. That's not helping anyone. After 12 more minutes are cut for brevity, he's moved to Weddle's living room and is sitting in a recliner, foot dangling off the right arm of the chair. He's smoking a cigarette and ashing onto the shag carpeting of Weddle's home, as well as drinking directly from a bottle of wine taken from Weddle's cabinets. It's noted that the wine is an inexpensive and common vintage. The host then states that the most challenging aspect of your HR career is handling medical benefits questions. The secret is to not read the documents, and instead just always say, "I'll have to look into it," when someone comes to you with questions, and then, if possible, don't get back to them. if they're persistent, find a way to ruin their day, just a little. Medical benefits aren't a human right, and they should be happy they're given any benefits. He also says that they should read their own damn documents. It's 1992. This ain't a fantasy story, and people should be content with what they get. It's noted that not only did Weddle not live in that residence in 1992, he didn't even live in the same country as that residence at the time. The host rises from the recliner, grinds out the cigarette into the carpet, and drains the mostly full bottle of wine in 20 seconds. He then turns his back to the camera and approaches a potted ficus tree in the corner of Weddle's living room. The sound of a zipper and a stream of liquid hitting plastic leaves is audible on the recording. He then mentions sexual harassment, calling it the best subject. Not because of sex, but because of the harassment. People being unhappy is his thing. The sounds of liquid cease and the zipper is heard again, before he walks over to Weddle's sliding glass door leading to a small enclosed backyard. He opens the door and walks through, with the camera following, and continues speaking. He says that part of their job in HR is to take complaints and file them with the appropriate people. This is especially important because they don't want the corporation sued. The bottom line is literally your god, and they didn't get into HR because they were humanitarians. Make sure you tell the boss and the appropriate steps are taken when such a complaint is made. He might like it when people are miserable, but abusers can take a long walk off a short pier. He then stretches and yawns, looking up at the night sky. As he turns around to face the camera again, the view is shifted down so that only the bottom 50% of his face is visible. Blood starts to run down his face in twin rivulets, presumably from the area of his eyes. The blood stains his shirt and continues to flow as he speaks. He states that that's about all the time they have today, and to not forget to write those letters with any questions to Vikander Need Technical Media Human Resources Orientation. They're here to help, not the employees, obviously, but you know what he means. He then bids Weddle to say goodnight as he starts waving in an animated fashion for 15 seconds. He finishes by thanking Weddle and ending the tape. On December 3rd, 2016, a rentable storage space was discovered by searching out properties in the area owned by any entities labeling themselves as Vikander Need. The storage space had been rented out for the last 35 years, paid entirely in advance in cash. Hundreds of VHS tapes were discovered within, labeled as Vikander Need Technical Media, with over half of them being copies of the Human Resources Orientation series. The classification has been changed to Keter, and research is being formulated to discern the nature of the tapes not covered by the 5904 designation. Next, we have SCP-5479, an anomalous film produced and distributed by VKTM entitled A Movie of You. The film depicts events in the past week of the viewer's life, as if a camera crew had followed the subject. It's edited and directed to a level of quality usually reserved for professional documentary films, and features narration from a male individual showing 95% match with the vocal patterns of actor Jeff Bridges, although Foundation agents have, of course, confirmed that Mr. Bridges has no knowledge of this anomaly. I sure would have loved to hear that conversation. On June 17th, 2011, Foundation agents embedded in the Georgia State Police were notified of a panic at the first annual Shiloh Film Festival. 5479 had premiered at the festival earlier that evening, and individuals who had seen the film were being treated for acute dissociative states and post-traumatic symptoms. Several individuals were hurt in the ensuing panic, but none of the injuries were life-threatening. MTF Gamma 5 were mobilized to take statements and administer amnestics to those who had viewed the film. Festival records were also altered, and Foundation personnel retrieved all promotional materials and the film itself. No VKTM representatives were present at the showing, and when interviewed, the managers of the festival were unaware that the film had been added to the roster. They had no idea how the film had received the festival's official selection before such deliberations had even occurred. We're once again just given some excerpts from the film, transcribed by a Foundation researcher who was amnesticized afterwards, listed only as Researcher B. The title card states that it stars the researcher, causing her to pause the film and call up the site director. She says that she doesn't understand, and then the site director speaks for several minutes before she just says that she'll do her best, and she hangs up. She continues the film, which brings up text showing the date of Monday, June 18th, 2011. It cuts to D-Class Wing Alpha at Site 19, as the researcher waits at the checkpoint looking at her tablet. Jeff Bridges begins his voiceover, stating that the researcher had a long day ahead of her, with a backlog of memetic anomalies to review. But first, she's picking up a test subject. The camera swings up to look down one of the two walkways adjacent to the D-Class residential units. Site 19 security is escorting a D-Class towards the researcher, telling them that they will accompany the researcher to the testing lab and follow her instructions. The researcher nods and begins walking back in the opposite direction, with the D-Class following closely behind. The film then cuts to the researcher and her subordinate, a junior researcher, looking through an observation window into a testing chamber. The D-Class is assessing examples of memetic filters, testing for effectiveness. After looking at one picture, they say that they feel dizzy, like they've been in a hot shower for too long. They ask if they can look away yet, but Researcher B shakes her head and just says to keep them informed if anything changes. Her and the junior researcher then chat about another doctor that lost a couple more D-Class, before they look back through the window and see the D-Class slumped over the desk. The researcher swears and enters the chamber, gathering up the tablet and being careful to avert her eyes until the memetic filter is turned off. She takes a few moments to run a diagnostic program before announcing that it's okay. The junior researcher says that they better call in for medical, and the researcher sighs and says that she supposes so. Jeff Bridges quips on the voiceover that here at the SCP Foundation, it's the bedside manner that really sets them apart from your more traditional internment camps. The screen then cuts to black before the date for the next day pops up. The screen then opens up in a large auditorium-styled meeting room, subsequently confirmed to be Briefing Room Beta at Site 19. The researcher is sitting in the audience as the HMCL director continues speaking. Jeff Bridges states that it's just another day in the life of a Level 3 researcher, but life at the Foundation was far from ordinary, as even the bureaucracy has its sacrifices. The HMCL director says that they've had another 3D-class dead in 173's containment. This is ridiculous, as they know what is necessary and they know how to deal with the stupid statue. He asks a researcher to explain how they lost another 3 yesterday, with the researcher just chalking it up to human error. They had been involved in cleaning operations on 2 other occasions. The director swears at him, however, stating that these are important assets, unless he'd like to be in there hosing down the feces and the blood. The researcher doesn't respond, so he continues, saying to the whole room that they don't have endless bodies to throw at these anomalies, and to not take the D-Class for granted. They may be disposable, but they need to be preserved like any asset. He sighs again and says that it's time they changed the system around the statue anyway, as there's no reason they can't automate. He dismisses the room and Researcher B files out of the room with her colleagues. As she approaches the memetics lab, an alarm starts ringing, causing her to hurry in and secure the lab door before grabbing a pistol out of her desk. She sits behind her desk on the floor, gun gripped tightly, as Jeff Bridges states that one might ask what she did to deserve this, But the stark truth is that people don't get what they deserve, they just get. There is a pounding on the lab's door as explosions are heard deeper into the facility. Someone is yelling through the door, and the researcher braces her arms across the top of the desk, gun pointed at the door. The yelling is indecipherable through the door, and Jeff Bridges continues, stating that her heart beats intensely, sweat pours down her back, as it's been too long since she was on a range, and she hasn't fired the gun in months. The yelling through the door becomes clearer as the distant explosions momentarily cease, with it turning out to be the D-Class, shouting for her to let him in. A voice comes over the intercom stating that a containment breach is in process, and all non-security personnel are remanded to their stations and ordered to perform lockdown procedures. The door to the lab is struck hard, twice, by a metallic object, and Researcher B shakes her head. Jeff Bridges ponders what sort of containment breach it is, and what if this isn't the D-Class, as the D-Class pleads with her to let them in. The metal clanging reaches a high tempo, finally breaking the electronic lock and allowing the D-Class to wedge open the door. The klaxon continues to sound, in addition to the lab-specific alarm that begins as the secure door is breached. The D-Class lurches forward towards the researcher's position behind the desk, with him bleeding from a wound on his scalp. He yells for her to help him, but she shakes her head violently and tells him to get out. Jeff Bridges comments that she's got a serious moral quandary here, as the D-Class broke into a secure lab during a containment breach. He is injured, though, and a D-Class, so maybe he doesn't know what the lockdown procedures are. Besides, security personnel scramble their brains damn near weekly. The researcher yells at him to get out again as a final warning, but he refuses, moving towards her and reaching out for her hand. She fires her sidearm twice into his chest, with him falling backwards and landing on the tiled floor of the lab. She hurries around him and slams the door shut, wedging a stool against it. She turns back to the D-Class and watches as he dies, her arms shaking. Jeff Bridges muses that D makes sense now. The film then cuts to a montage of security personnel clearing the room, with maintenance repairing the door. Researcher B stands near her station, the firearm on the desk in front of her. She does not look at it, or the body. And the film cuts to a small hearing with members of the Ethics Committee as she stands silently in front of the two seated committee members. One of them tells her that, given the situation, they think she performed admirably. Her primary concern was the safety of herself and the security of the lab, that is her station, with this all being in accordance with protocol when a containment breach or other emergency takes place. The other member remarks that they've all been in containment breaches before, so they know how terrifying it can be. It has been confirmed, however, that the D-Class had not been affected by the containment breach, the nature of which they will not be discussing today. She grips her hands tightly in front of her, and there's a fine tremor in her arms. Ultimately, however, she had no way of knowing whether he was affected, or in fact what sort of anomaly had broken containment. She has testified that she was in fear for her life and the security of her station, and the surveillance footage bears this out. Thus, despite the tragedy of the D-Class's demise, it is the decision of this body that it was a result of his own actions, so they find her not guilty of professional negligence. She hesitates and says that she killed a man, and asks if there's no consequences for that. They reply that in this situation, there isn't, although they could refer her to some security-cleared therapy. Honestly, though, it might be easier for everyone involved if she was amnesticized, and they ask if she has any problem with that. She shakes her head, and so medical personnel come into the room and administer amnestics to her as the camera fades to black. Jeff Bridges comments that all's well that ends well, and a lesson has been learned, even though she won't remember it. Besides, what did he think was going to happen? as he wasn't putting the ideals of the Foundation first, and that way lies disaster. The researcher pauses the film and swears, murmuring to herself, and asks herself if any of that happened. The phone rings in the chamber and she picks it up, listening for a few moments before saying that it doesn't seem to have any memetic effect. She does say that she's not doing well with this, watching yourself do things you don't remember, and says it's disturbing. She listens for a little while longer before interrupting to ask if this actually happened, but she's interrupted herself. She thanks the director and hangs up to continue the film. The date shown on the screen is now Wednesday, June 20th, 2011. It opens on the memetic lab, panning around before showing researcher B and the junior researcher. B is turned away from the camera, but the junior researcher looks in the general direction of the camera, almost making eye contact, before looking away. They are both laughing about a fellow researcher, before the junior researcher asks her where she was yesterday. She wasn't in the lab in the morning, and wasn't at lunch when the alarm sounded. B says that she had a meeting with the HMCL committee, and then took the rest of the day to run some errands. The junior researcher says that there was a containment breach, and a D-class died right here in the lab, to B's surprise. The junior researcher says that it was actually one they'd worked with a few times, listing his number, to which B just shrugs and says that she has the damnedest time remembering their numbers. Jeff Bridges finishes by saying that if he were on screen right now, he'd be giving the camera some serious side eye. The researcher stopped the film at this point, and 15 minutes later, appeared at director Moose's office to discuss the movie's contents. The contents of that discussion are not part of this record, but the director noted that she was irrational and frantic about her viewing of the anomaly. After several minutes, security was called and she was taken away. Ethics committee members determined that the best course of action for all involved was to amnesticize the researcher concerning her viewing of the film. She was then allowed to return to her normal work duties the following day, with a classified demerit on her personnel file. Director Moose reported her concern to the O5 Council regarding 5479 being studied by those researchers who had contact with D-class or other ethically challenging, sensitive responsibilities. The special containment procedures were amended accordingly, such that the anomaly would be transferred to a site without D-class in order to avoid such complications in the future. While not quite as weird and inexplicable as some other VKTM pieces, it's no less confounding to those who experience it, although there's certainly an argument to be made for wanting to view your life narrated by Jeff Bridges. Let's finish with SCP-5379, a photography and film stock storefront operated by VKTM, entitled VK Technical Media Solutions. It appears seemingly at random within existing storefronts, displacing their original occupants to parts unknown for the duration of its manifestation. It functions as a typical facility of its kind, offering a variety of blank film to its customers, and also offering film development and tape transfer services. However, anything recorded on film purchased from the storefront is dramatically altered, frequently in ways which should not be possible. Examples include uncropped photographs, untrimmed film, the inclusion of new media elements, references to information known only to the owner, and the substitution of entirely new pieces of media. Personnel employed at the displaced facilities are left with hazy recollections of a vacation to explain their disappearance. Nestic Treatment has recovered only partial, although apparently true, memories of attending a corporate training retreat during their absence, with the theme of keeping your premises actually yours in the future. While participants are unable to recall the curricula of this retreat, it is apparently effective, as no storefront has been co-opted by the anomaly more than once. It only alters the interior of the structures it occupies, and its manifestation is therefore exceedingly difficult to track. Foundation operatives typically only become aware of manifestations when the items they produce result in attempted law enforcement action. In every case, the anomaly has disappeared before such action can be taken, and well before Foundation operatives can gain access. It also engages in periodic, memetically effective advertising campaigns to promote its services, and we're given a transcript of a television commercial that was broadcast on all commercial stations in Little Rock, Arkansas, on May 18, 1979. In it, a haze of orange and yellow, presumably smeared on the film negative, swims across the screen. The scene appears to be the back rooms of a butcher shop. A large piece of unidentifiable meat hangs from a hook suspended from the ceiling. A man in a t-shirt is visible in a mirror on the wall, seated on a toilet. He breathes deeply and speaks in a monotone and does not look into the camera. He says that he doesn't even know, followed by 5 seconds of silence, followed by saying, "Take my wife, VK Technical Media Solutions, and all your film needs." There's then 3 seconds of sobbing in the background, which is abruptly cut off. The man then says, "Fishing with the boys, VK Technical Media Solutions, make me a sandwich, and finally, take my wife," as the meat begins to rotate on the hook. A logo appears for Vikander Need Technical Media Solutions, with the accompanying slogan, "Media for Men," sloppily overlaid over the slogan, "There is no glass ceiling." Shortly after this commercial aired, the Foundation became aware of several incidents of the anomaly manifesting and events related to film purchased at those locations. A man named Morris Brown had taken in a collection of old photographic negatives to have them developed. Annotations in an angry scrawl matching his handwriting can be found on the resulting photographs, offering frank interpretations of the character of the persons on display, or issuing vague accusations against them. These persons are invariably female. The alterations were discovered by Brown's nephew, the executor of his estate, who made a report of vandalism to the police. Forensic personnel confirmed that the photographs had been developed directly from the negatives, which do not feature the accompanying scrawl. The examiners were pressed by Foundation agents to reverse their conclusions under duress and then amnesticized. A notice was placed in local newspapers correcting the earlier police report and confirming that an act of vandalism had taken place. The executor withdrew his complaint, and his amnesticization was deemed unnecessary. The incident was investigated and logged, but since anomalous interference could not be confirmed, no subsequent action was taken. The file on 5379 was officially opened after the discovery of the next instance of altered media, in which the anomalous nature was irrefutable. In June of 1979, an American filmmaker named John Bedfield attempted to sue the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times for the theft of his latest film from its storage container and its replacement with an unrelated piece of media. The film, entitled Run, had been replaced with a 2-hour review of Run by noted critics Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert as part of their regular program At the Movies. The episode in question never aired, and was likely never recorded, as Run was never officially released, and At the Movies did not begin airing until 1986. The opening titles for the show incorporate a logo for Vikander Need Trash Mockery, with the accompanying slogan, "You're poor in talent, but rich in lack of talent." In an excerpt from the review, Siskel says that he thinks he's reached the point in his life where he's willing to step back and say, no, not everything committed to film is potentially a work of art. This mess certainly isn't. Ebert retorts that he can't decide that unilaterally. If anyone's going to do that, it should be him, as he's a far more competent arbiter of taste than Siskel is. Siskel asks if he's serious, to which he replies, of course, and he's much more eloquent to boot. He's a real Renaissance man. Siskel counters that he watches smut in the theater, and he can't stand in jest, in judgment over all cinema. Ebert replies that he's not standing, he's sitting, and so is he. That's how he can keep putting his foot in his mouth without falling over. Siskel then asks if he's saying that he likes this film, to which Ebert laughs derisively and says, of course not, as it's trash. He did enjoy the eye candy, though, as those parts were shot well. Siskel agrees that the sex scene was very tasteful, and that's why he's surprised that Ebert liked it. Ebert doesn't reply, instead sipping his soda quietly, and when Siskel remarks on him not having a snappy comeback, Ebert replies that he's sharpening his straw into a shiv. It's noted that Run was an emotional portrayal of the director's attempt to reconnect with his estranged mother during her campaign for public office in Thurmont, Maryland. Most of the runtime consisted of black and white footage of door-to-door canvassing, town meetings, and local events. It had no sex scene. After Bedfield's amnestization, a notice was placed in local newspapers retracting his lawsuit. No further examples of affected media were detected until an anonymous tip brought agents to the scene of a domestic quarrel in Little Rock, where a married couple were fighting over the contents of a VHS tape. The tape, which originally contained their wedding film, had now been replaced with footage from what appears to be a beach party, dated 2 weeks prior. The man is accompanied by a young woman with whom he shares several increasingly intimate interactions. His best man is visible in the background of the earlier shots, engaged in obvious intimate advances with a second young woman. The opening titles now incorporate a logo for Vikander Need with the accompanying slogan, "Tarnishing Memories." The young woman with the man is noted as being a close friend of the couple, and the woman with his best man was similarly not his spouse. Upon reviewing the film, the man's wife attacked him with a wine bottle and several fireplace implements before a family friend convinced her to leave the house. The couple have since divorced. No police report was filed, but an anonymous informant telephoned Site 43 to connect the event to SCP-5379, although they could not subsequently be located. A notice was placed in the local newspapers taking credit for the tape switching as an act of vigilantism, which seems like a curiously unbelievable cover story. The Foundation continued to monitor director John Bedfield, which led to the recovery of another piece of altered media. The media was his personal copy of a 1979 film entitled Belgian Connection, which now featured a commentary track with Bedfield's voice, which he claims to have not recorded. Most scenes contain extra footage not in the final cut, which he claims to have not filmed, and the opening titles now incorporate a VKTM Kids logo, with the accompanying slogan, "We don't know what we're doing, so you don't get to know what we're doing." An excerpt from the film shows a young woman sitting on a hotel bed with wrapping paper discarded on the sheets beside her. She is reaching into a box in her lap, and Bedfield's commentary states that this was going to be the moment. She removes a book from the box, although the title is unreadable, as Bedfield says that she had to understand the import of the gift and what he was trying to tell her with it. This was the moment when she'd finally tell him that she loved him, that she understood him. The woman then shrugs and replaces the book in the box. She closes the lid, smiles weakly at the camera without making eye contact, stands up and walks out of frame. The camera does not follow, as Bedfield says again that this was going to be the moment. The scene then cuts to the following day, where the woman is browsing wares at a street vendor's stall. Bedfield finishes by saying that this is where he was going to put the sex scene, but the producers convinced him to save it for the finale. It's noted that the film was an emotional portrayal of Bedfield's European vacation with his adopted sister in an attempt to connect. It had no producer, no hotel room scene, and no sex scene. Bedfield checked himself into a mental health facility after reviewing the altered film, where embedded agents amnesticized him. A notice was placed in the local newspapers on behalf of the local film community, wishing him well and attributing his breakdown to stress and overwork. On July 2, 1979, the director of Site 43, Dr. Scout, received a red line telephone call from a man claiming to be privy to sensitive information about both VKTM and the SCP Foundation. Agents detained Little Rock resident Dr. Alan McInnes at Site 73 in Texas, and Dr. Scout traveled from Canada to question him. Scout remarks that if he'll forgive the cliché, it's obvious that he's not from around here. McInnes replies that clichés are the building blocks of communication, but yes, he's from England. Most of his people are still in England, but a few left for Canada, and only one left for America, his uncle, Morris Brown. Morris Brown was the first victim of 5379 a month prior, and McInnes says that he received a letter from a lawyer a few months back, stating that he had been appointed the executor of his uncle's estate. That's how he discovered the photographs, and he knew there was something wrong the instant he saw them. He knew that his uncle couldn't have scribbled those notes, despite never having met him, as his house was immaculate, with everything in its place. He wasn't the sort to drive invective into a photograph, but he was the sort, if his parents are to be believed, to let it fester in his heart until no one could stand to share a room with him. He was also a diarist, and McInnes had copious examples of his handwriting to compare with that angry scrawl. It was his hand, but it wasn't his style. Dr. Scout says that he suspected vandalism then, but McInnes says no, although that's what he told the police. There were no signs of forced entry, and the house was in order, so he filed the incident away for later. His uncle had also left behind a roll of blank camera film and a few blank video cassette tapes, all VKTM branded. He decided that he would use the film and his uncle's camera to document his possessions as his executor. He'll spare all the gory details, but for one example, the photograph he had taken of a lovely wicker basket his mother had once made for his uncle was now covered with a few choice sentences in his own neat handwriting. It read, "Mother loved him better. Father never knew." He had had his suspicions, as there was a reason his uncle moved to America, and families talk. He naturally developed the hypothesis that the film carried anomalous properties, which was the only sensible conclusion. He did want to know if the police had seen any other evidence of this paranormal activity, however, so he submitted the photograph to them as evidence of vandalism. He was astonished at how quickly what should have been a shocking story was swallowed up by red tape. He takes it that this was the Foundation's doing, but Dr. Scout just replies with no comment. McInnes assumed that he was being watched, so he quietly dropped the matter and returned to work. His uncle left precious little money behind, and he needed to get a job. Since his background is in communications, he attached himself to a local public relations firm connected with film and television productions. He admits that he was hoping to have his suspicions confirmed, but he was surprised how easily it happened. Within a week, he'd met a local affiliate who had run that absurd commercial without remembering ever agreeing to it, and a filmmaker who claimed his amateur film had been somehow vandalized by his tape recorder. He was fascinated, and Scout asks him if he wasn't afraid. McInnes replies that he fears mundanity, not absurdity. In his time at the firm, he'd befriended a fellow HR specialist, a woman named Sarah Walker. She was married to a truly boorish idiot, the man who cheated on her on the beach, and McInnes imagined that if he loaned the boor one of his uncle's VKTM tapes, asking him to record his wedding video onto it for him, he could use him as an experiment. He assures Scout that it couldn't have happened to a nicer man, and he was there with them when he played it back to make sure it was working correctly. He was glad he was there, though, as she very nearly killed him, and McInnes called up the Foundation to make sure they noticed. Scout replies that none of this explains how he got their number. McInnes explains that he suspected he was being watched, and he saw the pieces the Foundation posted on behalf of Mr. Bedfield in the newspaper. Having heard the real story from the man himself, he knew it was them, whoever they were, so he cut one of them out and took it to the local VKTM store to blow it up to poster size after seeing another one of their commercials. Scout nods and gestures at a large cardboard tube on the table, which was being carried by McInnes when he was brought in. He opened it up, pulling out the poster and laying it on the table. He reads it carefully, then considers it for a moment, before asking McInnes if there's any chance he can break his contract with the PR firm. The post contained the item number, object class, special containment procedures, and description for SCP-5379, along with a telephone number and code phrase required to reach MTF Kappa 43 in case of a sudden manifestation of an SCP-5379 location. It also contained the number of Dr. Scout's red line telephone. The following day, Scout offered McInnes a position at the Foundation if he would assist in the continued surveillance of VKTM. McInnes agreed to the terms and underwent extensive training over the following 3 weeks at Site 73. In the meantime, Scout monitored communications in Little Rock for a recurrence of the 5379 phenomena. When a third round of commercials was finally aired, McInnes was summoned back to Little Rock, being sent to the new VKTM store and instructed to purchase as many different varieties of media as could be found on offer. When he arrived, however, he found the store completely empty, save for a single VHS tape sitting on the reception counter. The content of the tape begins by showing waves of sharp white smoke radiating off the motionless figure of a man standing in a tiled shower stall. The man is looking down, and the camera only captures the top of his head, which is covered with shampoo suds. There is a constant sound of running water, but no water is running. The man says that you should smile more often, followed by 19 seconds of silence, and then he asks, "What did you expect?" He shakes his head, but still doesn't raise it, and says that this show isn't for you. This show is for them, but maybe you got the message anyway. There's 12 seconds of extremely loud static, although the picture is unaffected, but water begins to spurt from the shower head until the static stops. The man then says that this is just the beginning, as he reaches up to gently massage his scalp. He then says, "VK Technical Media Solutions," before abruptly beginning to pull the hair away from his scalp, hard. He finishes by saying that boys will be boys, as the skin on the man's scalp begins to tear away and the image abruptly cuts out. Wet, biological tearing sounds continue for the next 129 seconds, before a logo appears for Vikander Need Technical Media Solutions, with the accompanying slogan, "Little Rock, Arkansas, most sexist town in America," sloppily overlaid on the slogan, "Congratulations on the new job, Alan." No further VKTM Solutions manifestations occurred in Little Rock, although the stores have periodically re-manifested, always in a new urban location, always with a new topical focus and advertising slogan. Examples have included "You Earned Your Trust Fund" in New York City, "Go Ahead, Say It Anyway" in Boston, and "Slogans Are a Valid Substitute for Morality" in Las Vegas. Well, there you have it. And as promised, we still don't have any further understanding of their goals or operations than when we started. It's true that not every group of interest needs to be fleshed out with pages upon pages of backstory, and really all we need are just a collection of articles with a common theme. I definitely don't think VKTM are in any way benevolent or helpful, but they're also not overly malicious either. They're just continuing to inject more and more unusual things into the US, which is a little malicious.